Thank you, Zaid, and welcome everybody. I'm just going to speak today about the ideological dimension of de-radicalization, by which I mean the process of change. Is this working or not? That's this one, okay. Sorry. The process of change towards the delegitimization and the abandonment of political violence against the state and the society. If you looked at the history of changes within Islamist movements, you'll find three types of processes that usually takes place. One is radicalization, the change for the demand of sweeping social and political changes within the society, and sometimes the way to expedite such changes is via violence, and it becomes violent radicalization at this point. And then we have another type of change, which is moderation, usually the demand for a plural society, acceptance of the other, democratization, usually centered on liberal ideas. And then we have the third type of change, which is de-radicalization, which is focused mostly on political violence, not necessarily democratic values or liberal values. If we looked at the current situation, we'll find these processes of abandoning political violence taking place in more than 20 countries. Egypt and Algeria and Tajikistan started in the 1997, in the late 1990s. Mainly as collective de-radicalization, meaning abandoning of political violence happening at an organizational level. An organization like the Islamic Group in Egypt, or the Islamic Salvation Army in Algeria, or the militias affiliated with the Islamic Renaissance Party in Tajikistan, declaring a unilateral ceasefire and behaviorally intending to abandon the path of political violence. But also we saw this process happening at the factional level, meaning that the organization as a whole did not abandon political violence, but some of the factions within such organizations did so. We see that currently with Al-Jihad organization and with groups that were affiliated once with the GIA and the GSPC in Algeria, as well as others. And we see it also happening on the individual level, especially under government-sponsored programs in Saudi Arabia, in Yemen, and even here in the United Kingdom. So usually we have these two types of de-radicalization happening under processes, an interaction between a particular organization, the state, and the society, or under a government-sponsored program that is focused mostly on individual militants trying to convince them to abandon political violence. And these are some of the examples on the board in Algeria and Tajikistan as processes, Saudi Arabia and Yemen as programs. Now, this process has multiple dimensions. The first one that usually comes under radar is the behavioral dimension, which usually comprises the element of abandoning political violence, declaring the intention of not to use armed action to expedite change in the society, and usually comes in the form of a unilateral ceasefire, or other elements, or sometimes without if there's no confrontations going on, just a declaration of intention that the organization in question will not use violence as a method of change. Then this is usually coupled by the ideological element, which I'm going to talk about more specifically today, that has to do with delegitimization of political violence via theological and ideological and rational arguments. And then you have the most challenging dimension of this process is that of the organizational type. Usually, it entails the dismantlement of the structure within the organization that supports the violence, dismantlement of the units, the command and control, and then the disarmament of the members and their demobilization, their successful demobilization, so that no mutiny happens, no factionalizations happens, and no attacks on the leadership that supports de-radicalization happens, as we saw in some of the cases. So I'm not... actually, before getting into the cases, if the three dimensions of de-radicalization, the behavioral, the ideological, and the organizational happen, usually that's a comprehensive package, and usually if this happens, de-radicalization is quite successful. If the organizational dimension is missing, meaning that you'll have factionalization and mutiny within the organization, but the behavioral and the ideological are present, usually I call it substantive de-radicalization. And if the ideological dimension is missing, it's usually a pragmatic one, and the most dominant type in Algeria, for example, is the pragmatic de-radicalization, an abandonment of violence, demobilization of the of militants, but at the same time, no ideological recantation to delegitimize political violence. And sometimes, you know, there is an attempted process of de-radicalization and it fails. The earliest case is that of the Muslim Brothers back in 1951, when the General Guide attempted to disband the special apparatus, the armed wing of the Muslim Brothers back then, and it ended up into a mutiny, an attack on the leadership, and it wasn't a successful case. But that changed in the 70s, in the early 70s, when the armed wing was disbanded for good. These are some of the cases on the board here that occurred in Egypt with this and in Algeria. But it's not all, obviously it's not limited to these countries. It's more than that. And I'm not going to speak today about the causes of this process or how successful. Or the conditions for a successful de-radicalization, or how successful some of these processes are. Those are covered in some of my published works, if you're interested. But I'm going to speak specifically on the ideological dimension of this process, how former jihadists take away the legitimacy from what they believe or what they previously believed as jihad and qital. If you looked at the jihadist literature, you will find almost all of the arguments can be listed under one of the of those titles inside the square. Those arguments can be, depending on the context and depending on the type of the argument, they can be classified. So if it's in an inside a Muslim majority state, the ideological / theological arguments will be about the hakimiyya, the idea of legislation is only a right for God, and if a an individual infringed on that right, then he ought to be fought. Or the ridda, if you infringed on this right, if a ruler infringed on this right, he's a murtad, and therefore he ought to be fought as well, murtad being an apostate. Or the idea of the establishment, the obligation of establishing an Islamist state, and the best way to establish this is via armed struggle. If you looked at the rational arguments within the Muslim majority states, you'll find them, one about the viability and the efficiency of fighting as a method. If you looked at the electoral process, jihadists would say, in Algeria, for example, the FIS won the elections with a landslide majority, in the seats at least, and it ended up being a coup, and most of the FIS leaders were arrested, and the leader of the party, rather than being called to establish a government, by the president, he was called into a concentration camp in the desert. So therefore, this is not a viable method, and maybe fighting would be a viable method to change and to establish the state. And there's also this rational borderline philosophical argument about the inevitability of confrontation. Confrontation between good and evil is a pattern in life, and it will happen sooner or later, and therefore we are just preparing and expediting such confrontation. And then you have in Muslim minority states outside the Muslim majority world, you'll find the argument, if there's a military, foreign military presence in such states, you'll find the argument of jihadid def, defensive jihad, as a way to either liberate the land or to secede from the land. Okay, I didn't get into the bulk of the lecture yet. So I'm going to quickly move on to the ideological dimension, because I'm sure you already know the Ahkam al-Diyar, basically Dar al-Islam and Dar al-Harb, and the idea of the neo-crusaders, which is, again, philosophical, borderline rational, between quotations. So if you looked at the some of the literature, you'll find around 25 volumes, maybe a bit more, published by the formerly jihadist Islamic group. You'll find as well some around 3 books published by the former leader of al-Jihad organization between 87 and 93, Dr. Fadl de Elias, but his real name is Sayyid Imam al-Sharif. And if you looked at the logo of the Islamic group down here, you'll find the they used to have a sword beside the Quran and the sun. And that sword is removed now, and the verse has changed from وَقَاتِلُوهُمْ حَتَّى لَا تَكُونَ فِتْنَةً, fight them until there is no fitna, and the religion is God's, to now وَأَقِيمُ الدِّينَ وَلَا تَتَفَرَّقُوا فِيهِ, a verse obligating, abiding by religion, and not differing in interpreting it. So these are some of the cosmetic changes, as well as the literature supportive of this change. And if you looked at this literature, you will find an inference, or sometimes, if you want a fancy word, a paradigm shift, looking mostly at a type of jurisprudence called the jurisprudence of consequences, or fiqh al-masalih, or sometimes fiqh al-maqasid, and sometimes fiqh al-nata'ij, jurisprudence of consequences, of results, and of interests. And basically, that's a theologically sanctioned pragmatism. The idea here is that jihad is not an end. It's a mean to an end. And and if jihad is hurting Islam, then jihad should be abandoned. The idea of jihad is to promote the interests of Muslims and the interests of Islam, and if this is not happening, then there has to be a shift. And there has been more of a reinterpretation of theological evidence in that regard. So you'll find the ayah of وَقَاتِلُوهُمْ حَتَّى لَا تَكُونَ فِتْنَةً in the old literature. You'll find the fitna referring to the oppression of the rulers and the lack of the sharia as a source of legislation. Now the fitna is basically the consequences of fighting, so the bloodshed, the chaos, the anarchy, and so on. And therefore, then there is no reason for qital, because qital will lead to fitna. The other thing you'll find in this literature is that it's discouraging political violence in general, not only against within Muslim majority world, so against rulers, against dictators, but also in general. So you'll find a book by Dr. Fadl criticizing Hamas in Gaza for a confrontation against Israel, the latest confrontation against Israel, and you'll find the Jama'ah issuing several statements criticizing Hezbollah's Israeli war and Hezbollah for capturing Israeli soldiers. And obviously a lot of critique of Al-Qaeda, Al-Jama'ah dedicated around three books to criticize Al-Qaeda's behavior and strategy and ideology. Also, you'll find in this literature a strong support for change, for transformation. Usually, the formerly jihadist literature, you'll find a glorification of continuity. That was Jihad al-Talab was there for a long time, Jihad al-Daf'a was there for a long time, and therefore we have to continue this tradition. But now there is they went through a lot long, sophisticated arguments about the necessity of transformation and the legitimacy of transformation and change and adopting more modern and, if you wish, even postmodern ideas. I'm going to go very quickly. I think I'm almost 1 minute. Okay. The two remotes get a bit confusing. So you'll find this is not really very new arguments. Most of these arguments, as one of the mid-rank commanders in the Jama'ah said, we heard this before. We heard these arguments before from Al-Azhar and from the Salafis, but now we're hearing them from particular individuals who have authority, who are leaders within the organizations. We know them, and that's what makes them credible. Most of these rely on a very long Sunni tradition of pragmatism when it comes to confrontation, because armed confrontation with rulers led to disasters within Islamic history, reference to the killing of the grandson of the Prophet al-Hussein, and therefore the idea of having an oppressive ruler without a confrontation better than having a fitna, a confrontation with an oppressive ruler that will just lead to bloodshed and massacre. And that idea, you'll find it well established both theologically and historically in the Islamic literature. Very quickly, a couple of other things. You'll find on the theological level, there's a shift towards the idea that the fiqh al-fiqh al-marjuh, the weakly established jurisprudence, is not cannot be just tossed aside. It is important to understand that even if there are arguments in the jurisprudence which have weak theological evidence, it's important to use them even though they are weak. And obviously this gives them more choice for the new ideology and the new path. I'm actually going to stop. I have one more slide about the impact and the critiques, but I'm going to just leave it up there, and maybe we can talk a little bit about it in the question and answers period. Thank you very much.